We have a surprise speaker because there were five Mondays this month, and it's really great. And people are always going, "Who's speaking? Who's speaking?"
Can't tell you the secret.
So it's better to give a resentment than to get one. Or
yeah.
So I was giving resentments all week. Yeah. The speaker for tonight is Lisa R. from really from Brooklyn. I didn't know that. She's surprised he was here. She's going to talk for 55 minutes. I'd like to welcome Lisa.
Brooklyn is in the house. Thank you, Mike. My name is Lisa Risi. I am an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober and at an AA meeting tonight. And I have my own heckling section, so that's great. My sober date is February 27, 1988. I'm a member of the Free Spirit Group in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. I'm a member in reasonably good standing there. I've been doing service there since I'm coming around, so I guess I'm in pretty good standing. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor people. So that's the stuff that's important about my AA membership. The rest of it is a lot of details. But, you know, I kid about being a member in reasonably good standing at my home group. When I came in there, it was typical Bensonhurst. I didn't have high hair, long fingernails, or enough gold. But I don't wear makeup. But there's this thing called the third tradition, so they had to let me come in anyway. And they let me stay because of that tradition. Thank God I have a sense of humor today from coming to these rooms. I have a very fond place in my heart for my home group, and I think it's the best group in AA, and if you don't feel that way about your home group, you should change it. Really, that's important. I want to talk a little bit about why I landed in this great institution we call Alcoholics Anonymous. I come from a long line of drinkers, but that's not why I'm here. I'm here because I fell in love with alcohol from the first time I was introduced to it. There was a lot of drinking in my house, and it seemed whenever we had company, the booze would really go flying, and people who were normally kind of boring got really kind of interesting once they had a few drinks, and then they'd start singing and dancing. And you know, I can't speak for anybody else in this room, and I'm a far away from home. You guys probably live differently than we do back in Brooklyn, but our get-togethers would end up with an ambulance or a police car or something, you know? And I really didn't know that, really until I came into AA, that things didn't end that way. I have to be honest, I've heard a lot of people share in rooms that, you know, they come from a long line of drinkers and swore that would never happen to them. I couldn't wait for my turn. I got to be honest. I was not turned off. I was not afraid. I was like, what about me? When do I get to do this? And I remember I'm one of seven kids, and my dad, who had an interesting approach to drinking, used to drink every night during the week, but would stay sober on the weekends, and I still don't understand that. But he would be kind of hungover on Saturday morning and traipse all seven of us out to give my mom a break. But somehow, whether we were going to Coney Island, Central Park, a museum, we always ended up back, on the way back, just to stop by and see his friends at the Queensboro Bar. And I loved when we went there, because I was always getting money from his friends, and you know, they were crazy in there, and I loved, like, the grandiosity of the bar. I mean, I loved it from when I was that high, and I really mean it when I say I couldn't wait for my turn. And I really didn't wait terribly long. I'm told, I don't remember it, I'm told that when I was about six, my dad thought it was funny to give me wine one night at dinner. And apparently I thought it was so fun, I kept refilling the glass, and they got a hoot out of it, and apparently I passed out at the table. And, you know, it really never got better than that, but I kept trying. But I didn't get sick, I don't think, that first time, so I guess that was the best time. But I really started drinking regularly when I was about 12. We had moved, and I was in this new neighborhood, and I was a new kid on the block, and we had moved from this housing project in Queens to Bensonhurst, which, not knowing the area, it's about as different as you can get. We'll just leave it at that. So I felt a little out of sorts, and really felt like I stuck out in the crowd, and I found this crew of kids that were willing to hang out with me, but they drank every day before school, and I kind of knew it wasn't any too bright, you know, but, and that I'd probably, it was just a matter of time before I'd get, well, get myself in a lot of trouble, but I guess I was just willing to do it because I didn't want to be the new kid with no friends. So I was like, I'll do this. That was like the first time. That's why I drank the first time with them. After that, I was like, I was the first one on the corner in the morning waiting. I mean, I have to be honest. I liked what alcohol did to me. I was very insecure. I was full of fear. I hated myself. I hated my family. I hated everything about me. And that first time I picked up a drink, I remember it clearly. It was like, I don't think I was finished with the first beer when, like, the transformation came, and I'm smart, I'm pretty, I'm funny, and you're lucky to be hanging out with me. Why wouldn't I drink? It's a good thing. And you know, I have to be honest, if it had stayed at that, I wouldn't come here. Why would I want to come here? No offense to anybody sitting here, but why would I want to come here? If alcohol was working for me, I would have kept at it. It took me outside of myself. It made me comfortable enough to be around other people and to talk to them and quite frankly, not care what happened. And, you know, I would never forget my troubles when I drank. I just didn't care anymore. It was just, well, that's a piece of information out there, but it didn't touch me anymore. And alcohol was great, and I loved it. And I always drank to get drunk. That was the point. I'm not someone, I don't know, they talk about some invisible line and someday it got bad and that really, I don't know, I guess I got born on the other side of the line, I don't know. But for me, the whole point of drinking was to get drunk, and the more you forgot, the better time you had. And I found out in AA that that's a blackout and a bad thing, but I really didn't know that because I hung around with people like me, and when I got worse than the people I was with, I found new people. I went through a lot of people, I have to be honest. Let's just say the cast of characters got seedier as time went by, and I was the seediest of them all in my own telling, but it's amazing for me what alcohol did. The things I used to say, that'll never happen. Oh my God, if that ever happens to me, put a bullet in my head. Well, I should be bullet ridden because it just seemed like every new low I got to, there was just yet another one around the corner. And there wasn't a lot of dignity or respect in my life when I was drinking alcohol. And it's a mixed room, and I have a little dignity and self-respect today, so we won't go into the details. But suffice it to say, I've yet to be shocked by hearing someone else's fifth step. So that's enough information, I guess, for the room. But I would find myself in these very precarious situations and always kind of see them as a fluke of this kind of thing that happened to me. You know, I would never see that I had set up all these things to happen from the way I was living. And I used to feel like that my life was like me, like I was a car on that track at the car wash, and life just shot things at me. Oh, here comes the hot wax, you know. But, you know, if you go into a car wash, you actually pay for what you want shot at your car. And the truth is, the way I live my life, the stuff that was happening, I set it up. You know, by what I was saying, what I was doing, who I was doing it with. And it was only until I got sober that I was able to see that connection and you know, I didn't see it. Somebody pointed it out to me, just for the record. And, cause I really couldn't see much on my own. And even now, I need a lot of help with that. But the reality is, I was the biggest victim in the world. You know, everything horrible happened to me. And, you know, I found out that with the exception of one thing where I was truly a victim in the sense of the word victim, my entire life, everything that happened to me, I was like, I'll volunteer, come this way, I'll do it. You know, that's really how I lived my life. I would go out, put myself in situations where really there was only one result that was going to come out of it, and I'd wonder, how the heck did I get here? You know, and the reality is, it was either related to something I did once I was drinking or something I did so that I could be drinking, you know, and all the lies, dishonesty, and everything that came with it, and the consequences that came with those things were all tied up to that. And a couple of basic defects of character, which, you know, drinking or not, are something I have to struggle with, and some patterns of behavior. But the reality is, I kind of knew not long into my drinking that it was problematic, and it was something that needed to be watched or controlled, or got to be careful about when I start that up. You know, I think very early on in my drinking career, I knew it was either a drinking day or a not drinking day. I had to let go of the fantasy that I was going to have a few and be home in a few hours. The woman who's since passed away at my home group, who would say, you know, as alcoholics, we can't count and we can't tell time. You know, and that's certainly true. You know, you get me and alcohol together, I can't do those things. And I'm an accountant by profession, so it's pretty pathetic. But at any rate, you know, I just kept drinking. That was my response to everything in life. And I had a lot of problems in my life. And like most people, I wasn't special, which is what I know today. At the time, you know, I was like a pretty big drama queen, and, you know, it was the end of the world, as Lisa Turns, you know, soap opera of the day. But, you know, the reality is that no matter what happened, whether a situation happened or people were talking about something that might happen, my first reaction to it, what? How does this affect me? That, I mean, I would know, I had enough social sense not to say that out loud, but that was what I was thinking. And if it didn't affect me, well, isn't that too bad? If it affected me, well, will it affect my drinking? No? Okay. We could probably work with this. You know, and, you know, towards the end, I couldn't even do all that thinking, so, like, things would happen, and my response was, well, it's nothing a couple of drinks can't cure. And that's kind of how I thought for a long time. And because of that thinking, I got into a lot of trouble. And my drinking got worse and worse, and the consequences of my drinking got worse and worse. And, you know, I found myself in a couple of situations. I had been dating this fella on and off for a long time, about 6 or 7 years. And he had gone away to the Navy while I was in college, and he had come back, and I was still dating a couple other people, and I had a problem with that one person, one thing, and daily thing. And I was starting to get some trouble at home from my drinking. They were starting to, like, call me on it. I'm, like, the second to the youngest, so as I was getting older, there was less buffer between me and my parents, so they were starting to notice more of the shenanigans I was up to, and now they're starting to call me on, what are you doing out all night? And so this fella asked me, he was having problems with his roommate. He goes, you want to move in together? And I didn't necessarily want to move in with him, but I did want to move out of my parents' house. But I was like, well, if I move in with him, I really need to stop seeing Jeff and Barry, and, you know, I'm, like, weighing all this out, you know? And, romance of a lifetime. And I'm all right, yeah, that's a good idea. and we go to tell my Italian American parents that we're going to move in together. Yeah, that went over like the blitzkrieg, and that was a lot of screaming and shouting, and walked out of my parents' house. So he says to me, "So what do you think? You want to get married instead?" All right. 45 minutes ago, I wasn't sure if I wanted to stop seeing Jeff and Barry. And a month later, I'm married. The only contribution I made to my wedding day was I bought the white shoes. My mom booked the judge. So my sister bought me a dress. Somebody else took care of the catering. I showed up, and I bought the white shoes. And that's just an indicator of how important that decision was to me. And I remember thinking that it probably should be different, but there I was. And I was in the middle of college at the time. And in the middle of a semester, so a little unmanageability going on there. And we get married, and I wake up the next morning, and I take one look at this gentleman, and I go, "What the hell was I thinking? I don't even like him." I stayed married for 5 years because that's who I am. That's who I am. And because quite frankly, being married put a lot of normalcy to my life. And it was a label I could wear to say I'm okay. You know, I'm legitimate. I'm now graduating from college. I have a job on Wall Street, and I got this thing called a husband. I have all the, badge and the hat, and I got it all, you know. And I am a normal human being, okay. And that was important because I was anything but normal. So I had to have these outside things that proved I was okay. But there were, you know, a couple problems with the marriage. He was very demanding. He wanted me home daily. Like when he was awake, dinner, house cleaned, home. And I had a tough time with that. I gotta be honest, go home and, cook dinner and watch TV or go out to the bar. I wasn't making it home a lot, and not that he was any walk in the park, but I'm telling you my story tonight. And the reality is that I meant to get home every night. Well, I couldn't, you know. There's this superpower glue that gets attached to my behind when I get in a bar that I cannot get myself off the stool. It's just there's nothing with enough power to get me off. The only thing to remove me from the stool is running out of money. It's the only thing I found that got me out of a bar or going to another bar. I had a habit of going to a lot of places because I always felt like I was 5 minutes away from wherever the best thing was. I don't know. I was always in search of something better. I moved around a lot on any given night I blacked out a lot, and the next day I would wake up with those ATM receipts in my pocket, because I fell asleep with my clothes on, and maybe $1 or $2 crumpled up, and I'd start pulling them out, and I go, okay, this was at 7 p.m., this is at 9, this is at 10, okay. I started out at Wall Street, got to here, and I would, from where I had went to get money, could piece together the night before. And that was almost daily. And I really only meant to go out for a few, And the reality is that once I pick up a drink, I lose all control. And that happened from the first time, and it continued until I got here. And the consequences just kept getting worse. And I got to a point in my life where I realized that drinking wasn't working. And well, first I thought I was going crazy, so I went to therapy. And I went there for a number of years, didn't tell her everything, and would go get drunk afterwards. And oddly, it wasn't working. But there came a point where I let something slip during a session that opened the door for her to talk to me about my drinking. And here's a woman who I've been seeing like once a week for 5 years, and all of a sudden I'm getting like highly indignant about the personal question she's asking me. How much do you drink? How often do you drink? What happens to you when you drink? Please, I'm here for my real problems. You know, the drink is holding me together, hello. You know, and it's like, she doesn't have a clue. You know, and no offense, I'm going to get like shot in 2 seconds. You know, she lived in New Jersey. What did she know? You know, Hausfrau from New Jersey. What is she going to do for me, you know? But this is a woman who I thought the world of up until she started talking to me about my drinking. You know, it's amazing, you know, how quickly I turn, you know. And so, you know, I did what any red-blooded alcoholic will do. I stopped going to see her. Thank you very much. But, you know, we talk in here about people planting the seed, and she wasn't an alcoholic, but she planted the seed. And that SOB, every time I drank after that discussion, like a picture of her would come in my head. I was like, she needs to die. She's ruining my drinking. She's ruining my drinking. It was going so well without her. And I was like, all right, she may be right. I got to stop this. So I decide I'm going to stop drinking. But I can't. I can't. Try as I might, wish all I want, I cannot stop. I'm not drinking today, I'm not drinking today, I'm not drinking today, 9 a.m. I'm not drinking today, I'm not drinking today, 9 a.m. Not drinking today, I'm not drinking. It's 1 o'clock. Who's going out for lunch? No, I'm not drinking today. Don't go out for lunch. All right. 4 o'clock, the round of phone calls. Are you thirsty? Are you thirsty? Are you thirsty? Well, I'm thirsty. Let's go. You know, and even if I made it through that gauntlet of the insanity of my mind, I had to get home. And there's a lot of alcohol available. And I was walking like this to get to the train because I couldn't figure out how to pass the bars I drank in and not go into them. I just couldn't. So I'm walking like 10 blocks out of my way to get on the subway and, pass the gauntlet, except where I got on the train, there were two trains that would come in, and one went to my neighborhood and the other one went to Bay Ridge, which is like the bar capital of Brooklyn. And if the Bay Ridge train came in, that meant I was supposed to go drink. There are a couple of places along the way where they're across the platform from each other. If the Bay Ridge train is there, it's meant for me to drink. So it was getting, I couldn't not drink is what it came down to. And I got really scared. Because I really wanted to not drink. And I couldn't not drink. And it was just getting worse. And the degrading behavior was getting worse. And there seemed to be no hope in sight. I looked at homeless people and said, it's just a matter of time. I know I'm going to be there. And I can't wait because the fight's killing me. I want to just give it all up. And who cares? I'm never going to win this battle, so let me just go join them, you know. And it was just a really dark, horrible place. And something happened. I went out to a party where I told myself I'm not going to drink tonight. And those were always the worst nights. And at 12:01, I decided the night had changed, and I'm going to make up for the lost, you know, the lost time. And I really went out on a tear. And I got home the next morning, and my sister-in-law was in the middle of giving birth, which was really inconvenient. And it was a horrible experience. I won't bore you with, but I wanted to kill her. because I needed to sleep, and she was making noise, and we had to keep taking her back and forth to the hospital about 5 or 6 times because there was something wrong, and I felt like I was in the 9th rung of Dante's hell. It was a horror, and she had to die, and finally we bring her back to the hospital, and they realize the problem. The cord was stuck around the baby's neck, and so they rush her in for an emergency surgery, and my brother goes in with her, and I walked out. I just left. I'm done. Delivered. You're here. And off I went to the barn. I was out. And I was gone. And I came back the next day. And I said to my mom, is everything okay? She was like, you care. You know, where have you been? I don't know. And I got to tell you, I really didn't care what happened until I got home. I didn't care. I didn't care enough to not leave. I didn't care enough to come back because I had started drinking. And I'd love to tell you that I got sober the next day. I didn't. It wasn't enough, man. I just couldn't stop. I hated who I had become. I wanted to change, and I couldn't. And I didn't know what to do. And I decided to go back to this therapist from New Jersey who doesn't know anything, because she had, you know, told me I had this problem, and I told her, I think you're right. And she says, well, you know, I can't help you. I said, excuse me? And she goes, I can't help you. And I said, then why did you tell me? You know, because apparently telling me was going to change my world, not like how I was living. And she says, no, I can't help you, but you can go to AA. Where? I mean, I didn't know anything about AA, but I thought, like old Irish guys went to there to die before, you know, or something. I don't mean to offend anybody in the room, but that's what I thought. And I won't look at anybody who I think even remotely looks like that. But the reality is, I felt like she said you have to chop off your left arm, you know, because I didn't know much, but I knew, like, if you go there, like, you'll never drink again, you know. And I said to her, that seems a bit extreme. And she says, the way you're living is extreme. Why don't you meet me at an AA meeting next week instead of coming to a session? And I was able later to look back and realize that God was looking out for me, because I don't know anybody else. I've been coming to AA for 15 years. I don't know anybody else that happened to. This woman went out of her way to make sure I got my sorry behind into an AA meeting. And I was living in Brooklyn. I was working in downtown Manhattan. So I found a meeting on the Upper West Side of Manhattan because I didn't want anybody to see me walking into an AA meeting. Like, just nights before, I was, you know, coming out of a cab minus a shoe with puke on my raincoat, to be honest. That's okay for my neighbors to see, but to see me walking, like, sober and upright into an AA meeting would be horrible. And really pathetic. And I go to this meeting, and there was an older, because, man, I'm getting a lot closer to these ages now, gentleman who was visiting from England, and I'm like, oh, I thought they're all Irish. We got an Englishman too. Great. And he starts telling my story, though, and I start doing, you know, what I've come to call the AA nod, because I was identifying what he was saying. And then he said something that made absolutely no sense to me. And I haven't had a drink in 18 years, and my life couldn't be better. I was like, oh, my God. How do you live like this for 18 years? I mean, I'm shaking, I'm sweating, I'm ready to jump out of my skin. How do you feel like this for 18 years? I didn't know, like, you got better, you know? And I'm thinking, you got to feel like this for 18 years, you know? Because I had never not drank for more than a couple of days. I never got past that shake, rattle, and roll stage. I didn't know it got better, you know? And I walked out of there, and I'm glad that I was crazy, because I thought, like, if you walk into one AA meeting, that's it, you're in this blood thing and you can't ever leave and now I'm never going to drink again. Oh my God, what did I do? And I'm standing there waiting for the train to go home thinking I might as well just throw myself in the trash, because the thought of spending the rest of my life and not being able to drink, kill me now, you know? You know, obviously I didn't, but that's how I felt. You know, the prospect of living my life without alcohol was horrifying to me, even though it was killing me daily. And, you know, a day or two passed. I'm sure they said make a meet in a day, but a couple days passed, and I decide that maybe I'll try another one of these meeting things. And I go to what's now my home group, and, you know, it's like early March. It's freezing out. And I'm standing outside the building trying to decide whether I really want to go to the same meeting. I didn't even have, like, enough sense to come in out of the cold to make the decision. And there's this guy at my group who, for some reason, opened the door, takes one look at me, and he says, it's kind of cold out there. Why don't you come inside? So I'm like, all right. So I come inside. He gives me the look over, and he's about 6'8". His name's Benny. He's from Bensonhurst. He's everything you can imagine. And he takes a look at me, and he goes, oh, I don't think we've seen you here before, young lady. I take one look at him, and I'm thinking, you'll never see me again. But that's on the inside, you know. On the outside, no, I haven't been here, you know. And he brings me into the room and gets me a half a cup of really bad coffee. And coffee's good at this group, by the way, so thank you, whoever the coffee maker is. And he introduces me to every woman in the room. I got to tell you, my first thought was, well, I'm recently separated. Why are you introducing me to women? Do I look gay? You know, I know I'm not wearing the high hair, makeup, and nails, but I'd like the guys' numbers, please, you know? That's what I'm thinking, you know? Yeah, because I was a catch. Yeah, they were all looking for me. they were just waiting for my year to be up, yeah. And, you know, and they're all giving me their number, and I can call them anytime. I'm like, great. I'd rather slip my wrist than call you, but thank you very much, you know. Because, you know, my mom brought me up right. I wasn't rude. I said, thank you. But I got, you know, yeah, I'm going to call you. And one lady asked me for my number. I got immediately my, why, you know. But, again, I'm not rude, so I gave him my work number because I didn't want to call me at home. I give him my work number, and the next day she calls me at work. Oh, these people, you know. Oh, but let me back up just a second, you know. So I sit through this meeting, and it was a long hour. And I get up, and we do this prayer thing, and I'm put my coat on, and there comes Big Vinny. Hey, where are you going? Home? Oh, no, there's another meeting. I said, all right, but I gotta go home. He goes, take the coat off, sit down, get to the next meeting. I'm like, oh, okay. Sit down, go to the next meeting. We get up again, do the prayer. I put the coat on. He comes over, what are you doing? And I said, there's not another meeting, is there? And he goes, no, we're going to the diner. I don't even recall the last time I've been in the diner. And I said, well, that's nice. I'm going to go home. He goes, no, you're coming across the street to the diner with us. And I said, I really need to get home. He goes, if we were going to the bar, you'd come, so you're coming to the diner. And I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? People in Manhattan didn't do this crap. They left me alone like I like. And so I go to the diner. It's just easier with Big Vinny. Just go. And I go to the diner, and they won't let me pay for my bad cup of coffee. And he says to me, well, you can repay the favor someday. I'm like, I'm going to be back. Yeah, okay. And I go to put my coat on, and he goes, where are you going? And I said, I don't know, Vinny, you tell me. You know? And he says, oh, we're going to take you home. And I said, oh, no, I only live a couple of blocks away. He goes, get in the car. All right, I'm not lying. It's a Lincoln Continental two-door. They put me in the back. All right. So we drive the four blocks to my house, and I want to go home now. And they're talking. I've had more people than I can stand, and I need a drink, and you gotta stop. And it just, he wouldn't stop, and this woman who took my number, and they're yakka, 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 and finally get to, so we'll be here tomorrow night at 6:30 to pick you up. And I'm like, I obviously missed something, but I was like, if that'll get me out of the car, because I want to, like, kick the window out and get the hell. And I'm thinking, I got to move. They're going to be back here tomorrow, you know. But this, in the vernacular I was using at the time, this chick called me the next day at work. I was like, these people are hounding me. And she asked me, what are you doing? So I'm going to go down to, what the hell was the name of it? Some name of the bar. And I said, oh, I'm going to go down there and get a burger. She goes, have you ever had a burger there? And I said, no. And she goes, where do you work? And I tell her, she goes, there's a meeting in 15 minutes, 2 blocks from your job. Get going. I don't know, but I went to the meeting. I don't know. And I made sure I got on the train enough time to be in front of my house at 6:30 because these people are coming. These freakazoid people. But they wanted me, so I went, you know. Because nobody else was asking me to go anywhere, to be honest, for some time. And I kept going. And this woman ended up becoming my sponsor. I dated her for a month before I asked her to be my sponsor. And, you know, I had to check her out, make sure she had a cool, like I knew anything, you know. What nerve, I tell you, I was crazy. And I followed around like a puppy dog, and if she stopped short, my nose hit her ass. I mean, that's the reality. I wanted everything that she had. I didn't have those words then. I just knew it was really nice to be around Annie, and it felt good. And, you know, that part of me hasn't changed. If it feels good, I'm going to go in search of it, you know? And that probably will never leave me. But I ended up asking her to sponsor me, and that was the best thing that ever happened to me. She introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They had been giving me the fellowship, and she showed me the program and the literature and got me to doing writing assignments and doing step work and doing service. And I didn't believe in God. She told me it wasn't a requirement for prayer. She had me praying right away. She said, anybody who honestly asks God to stay sober will stay sober. So you start doing it. Doesn't matter if you believe in Him, just start praying. And I was living with my brother at the time, and you know, literally days before, I'm on my knees puking in the bowl in the morning. But now that I'm going to pray in the morning, I got to close my door and pull down the shades because I don't want anybody to see me doing that, you know? And I really didn't believe, I got to be honest with you. I did the work for my first step, and it made sense, and it was clear I didn't have power. I mean, I knew that before I got into AA, I couldn't stop drinking on my own. And my life was a living hell. Unmanageable would have been an improvement. You know, I think I got there about 5 years into the program. It was all right, you know. And, you know, the reality is I had a tough time with spiritual concepts. And I had a lot of reasons. But she told me that as an alcoholic, the day was going to come where I would want to drink more than I'd want to stay sober, and that I may not be able to find anybody home. Usually when you're in that spot, you get all the answer machines. There may not be a meeting for hours. You find yourself in that situation, you better have a God. And like most things that I didn't understand or believe when she told me, I said, okay. Move on to the next topic. You know, it's easier to say yes. I learned that like by week 2 in AA. Don't disagree. Say yes. They move on to the next victim. Don't tell them, I don't know about that. I got a problem with that, because they're going to talk to you. Until they beat you senseless, so it's just easier to say yes. And they can move on, you know. And I did a lot of things in this program out of self-defense. I mean, I got a sponsor. It was easier to get her than to have to come up with yet another excuse why I'm on, like, day 30 and don't have one. So I got one. You know, and that's kind of how I went through this program initially. And, you know, the day happened where I wanted to drink more than I wanted to stay sober. And I got scared because I had never felt like that and not drank. And I felt it was just a matter of time. 5 minutes or an hour, I know I was going. And I was working in a bar that day, which was kind of a bad place to be, feeling that way. And I said, you know, I'm going to go in the ladies' room, wash my face, calm down a little bit, like I have some power over this desire to drink. And I walk in the ladies' room, and there are people snorting coke. I'm thinking, well, this can't be good. So I walk out of there, and I go into the office. I'm like, I got to call Annie. But I don't have my phone book with me, and, man, at that amount of time, I couldn't remember my own telephone number, never mind Annie's. And I didn't know where the meetings were around there. And it, I remember it came back to me, the thing she told me. And I closed and locked the door to the office, got on my knees. You know, can't be caught praying, you know. And I started praying, and it was a very advanced prayer, help. I don't want to drink, but I want to drink. Help me. Please help me. And I don't know how long I was praying, but you know that the knot in your stomach and the sweaty palms right before you're going to go have the drink? It left. That never happened to me without a drink. That never happened. And I didn't want to drink anymore for that day. And I finished my work, and I got the hell out of Dodge, and I didn't hang around to talk. And on my way home, I started thinking, I don't know what this God thing is, but I know that what she told me is true. I prayed for help, and I got it just when I needed it. And it was at that point I was able to accept the proposal, do I believe he's everything or nothing? I said, I'm going to believe everything. And I started going forward in the steps and made that decision to turn my will and my life over to him. And we didn't spend a lot of time on the third step. She was like, you made a decision, get to work. You know, just get to work, start writing. You know, I said, well, I hear all these people in the rooms, they're on their third step and they give their will and they take it back. She goes, don't listen to them. Look at the book. Right after you finish making this decision, at once, we begin. She was not 4 months later, not 6 months later, not after you ruin your life, at once. I said, okay. So I start writing. And, you know, it was not a big deal. I had been, you know, at step meetings and hearing people lament about the fourth step. But, you know, when I look back at it, the only people who were afraid of or lamenting over the fourth step are people who haven't done it yet. And the people who had, like, it was no big deal. And that was my experience, I have to be honest with you. The first time I did a fourth step, it was just something I wrote out. I felt like a news reporter just writing this as a story of what happened. I had no emotional attachment to it. And I took my fifth step with her. There was nobody else I was going to tell this nonsense to. And I'm not someone who, at the end of doing an inventory, had this great, glad that's over. I mean, my experience was, on that first one, was, well, I've been cursing all night, so why stop now? This is what I said to her. Holy shit, what a mess. And she laughed. And she said, well, that's what you get when you have a life run on self-will. Those are the results. Do you want them? And I said, no, it's horrible. I said, I have a lot of work to do. And she started laughing at me, which she did a lot for some reason. And she says, you know, I've been with you. I know you read the literature. I see you at meetings. She says, you've just got, by going through steps 1 through 5, you've become ready to have this stuff removed. You just said it's a mess and you don't want it. But God's going to remove it. If you had the power to remove it, it would have been gone already. Nobody wants to live like that. And that made sense. And she told me to get on my knees and to ask God for his help to remove these things. And she showed, you know, she says, when I leave here, I want you to go back over the first five steps, make sure you left nothing out, take an hour to yourself. I mean, she doesn't know no rocket science, but she goes, I'm showing you right out of the book the way I was shown, the way the person before me was shown. And I did that, and I took a break. Because when I write the steps, I put a 3-month break right there between 7 and 8. But as Lisa sees, it has it in there. And what happened for me was I had a lot of discomfort. I was ill at ease or diseased, and everything I had written in my inventory was coming back in spades. And, you know, doing that stuff without having booze to blame it on is really horrible. And it really strikes home that that's my core nature of who I am, you know, that when I want to run the show, this is what I resort to. I heard a great comment at a meeting about a month ago. This guy was sober about 25 years. It was a 7-step meeting, and he said that for him, he's found that self-pity is a default setting for him. I was like, oh, a default setting. I understand that. Like, when you don't do what you're supposed to do, this happens. And that was happening with all this stuff I had just said I wanted to be rid of. I'm starting to live it again. And she said to me, get on your knees, ask him again, and get to work. Get the pen out. And make that list. So I start making the list. But, you know, I'm not retarded, okay? I know what happens after you write this stuff down. I've been at meetings. I've heard about people, you know, going out to make amends, and it doesn't sound pretty. So I'm writing this stuff out, and it's like, it's killing me, you know? But I'm like, all right, I'm just making a list. But there were, like, these three people. They're not going on no piece of paper, because I know. I hear it all the time. And eventually I made amends to everybody on my list. I'm like, no blanking way. So if I don't put them on the list, then I don't have to do it. You know, yeah, I'm well. But I was well enough to tell her. I can't finish this list because I don't want to put these names on it, because I know if I put the names on it, I know what happens to people who put names on a list, you know? And she was just like, you really got to keep coming. And she goes, do you listen to what happens after they say that, how they live a life where they're free of fear, guilt, shame, and remorse, and they can walk anywhere, go anywhere, do anything? Yeah. She goes, don't you want that? You know, the thing is, I couldn't believe that. That was so foreign to how I was living my life. It just sounded like something people said nice at meetings, but do they really do that? You know, I had a lot of distrust, I guess. And I said to her, I don't know. She says, listen, do me a favor. Just put their names down. I said, I know where this is heading. She goes, just put their names down. Pray to put their names down, you know. And I'm standing here tonight, and I'm sober, so you have to know that I eventually did what I had to do, because that's the reality. She told me more times than I can count, because apparently I was a difficult case. Anytime you are unwilling to take a suggestion in this program, that means there's a part of you who thinks you're not an alcoholic. Because if we, as alcoholics, need this particular spiritual solution, and you're not willing to do everything that's involved, there's a part of you that thinks you're not alcoholic, and you don't need this. And that, like, when she talked to me like that, it was really hard to come up with a reason for not doing it, because you know, I was an alcoholic, you know, and I didn't want to drink. And the last name on my list was the first one I made amends to, so yeah, I was just another one of those stories, you know. And that's all good. I belong here. I'm part of this group. I'm part of every group I go to. I am a member of AA. I got the red badge of courage, you know. And the reality is that until I made direct approaches to the people that I had ruined, hurt, or otherwise damaged, I was never going to be free, and I could at any time pick up another drink. As long as I've got wreckage being carried around with me, a drink can look like an option, and I had to do that work. And I couldn't wait till it was convenient. I had to get out and do the work. And I'm grateful that I landed in a group who cares about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and who carry a message and don't water it down, whether you like it or not. This is the message. Take it or leave it, but this is the message. And I know that it could have ended up very differently for me. And I have a lot to be grateful for in this program. And she taught me how to do a 10th step from the beginning. I didn't realize we were doing them, which, story of my life, I never know what I'm doing. And she taught me how to do that. And she had a great line. You know, she goes, 10th step is AA's U-turn. You can stop at any time and turn around and get back on the right path with your 10th step. You know? And I liked that picture. That made sense to me because when I was drinking, you know, I'd start down a path that wasn't particularly good for me, and I knew it wasn't good, but this train has no brakes. You know, it's like, here I go. And like when I run out of steam, that's where I'm going to land. I mean, that's how I lived. And the 10th step allows me to go, this isn't working. You can stop now. Well, you could have stopped 10 blocks ago, but you could still stop now. And that's the beauty of this program, that I don't have to ruin something entirely before I stop it. And I have a lot of freedom in my life today because of that. And the 11th step comes after the 10th step for a reason. When I take a look at what I've done in a day, I am screaming out to God, help me again. You know, and put me in a place where I can help others. I've come to a point in my life where I feel that 10, 11, and 12 are very closely interwoven, and it's not about me. It's about me, but it's not about me. That the 11th step heals me from whatever damage I needed to deal with in my 10th step. And it heals me and puts me in a whole place, if only for a moment, so that I have a message to carry to the next alcoholic or to the next human being. You know, I don't feel that our message is limited to alcoholics. I have a way of life today that I can share with anyone. And if I can help, I'm going to help. I'm not going to check first, are you an alcoholic? I'll help you. No, you're a human being. I'll help you if I can, you know. And that's certainly a new way of life. And you know, I talked to you before about how the hand of AA was put out to me at my home group, and I have to say, sadly, that hand doesn't exist in every room of Alcoholics Anonymous for whatever reason. But I was lucky, fortunate, blessed, you took the word, it was all good, that the hand of AA was out there for me when I got to AA. We don't really get the opportunity to do traditional 12-step calls anymore. Most 12-step work is done at an AA meeting. Somebody shows up looking for help. They know who to come here. My job is to make sure the hand of AA is out there. You know, I struggle with this every time I go to my home group. I want to go see my 12 friends, 15 friends, whoever they are. I have to wave as I look around. I got to pan the room and say, who don't I know? And that's who I got to go say hello to first, because that was done for me. And it's not natural. It's not natural for me. I have to think about it before I walk into the room. Because if I walk into a room and I see Mike or Kathy, somebody I know, my natural inclination is to go where I know I'm loved and comfortable. But I have to look around for the person who looks like the last place they want to be is here and go say hello to them and put my hand out to them and live my life in a way that makes them think maybe there's something here. You know, I'm out of time. I'm just going to tell one story and beg your forgiveness for being a minute late. I was sober a couple of years in AA, and I'm sitting in a beginner's meeting at my home group, and a friend of the family, well, a friend of my family, but certainly not a friend of mine, walks in to AA and to my home group, and my first thought isn't great. My first thought is, of all the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, why is she in my home group? I'm sober, but I'm not necessarily cured, okay? But I have what we call at my home group sober feet, so I got up and I walked over to her and I welcomed her. And I introduced her to all the women, gave her the bad half a cup of coffee, dragged her out to the dorm, did the thing that we do. And still not liking her any more than I did before she got in the room that night. She wasn't in love with me either, just for the record. We were not in either one fan club. And she was coming around for a couple of weeks, and I don't know where we were talking, and she said to me, you know, I came to AA because of you. So I'm thinking, what the hell did I do? I need to never do that again. You know, on the inside again. And I said, what do you mean? And she says, you know, ever since you've been in AA, you treat me so much nicer. You know, and on the inside I'm thinking, but I still can't stand you. I mean, I gotta be honest, this is why I'm, because I get sober doesn't mean I'm gonna love everybody. Hello, I mean, I'm human, right? And I walked away and I said to her, well, I'm glad that I made you feel comfortable, and I'm walking away going, this thing must work, because I wasn't consciously treating her better. I honestly didn't like her any more than I did before I got into AA. But something happened to you, because I think from other people in AA showing me a life of dignity and respect, I started to give that to other people, whether I liked them or not, you know. Practice these principles in all our affairs, you know. Not just for the people we like. That's easy. I could treat the people I like well. You know, well, most days. And, you know, but that was a real powerful example to me that this program works in all conditions, in all places, with all people. And until I live my life that way, it's all nothing. Because, you know, up until she came into the group of AA, I was the only big book she saw. Thank God I was behaving with some dignity and respect and not like my natural self, you know. And I just wanted to share that. And, again, thank you for your patience in listening to me. And it's really been an honor to be here tonight to share my experience with you. I really think that the format you guys are doing is terrific. I wish the group well with it. I know it's new. And I'm just grateful to be a part of it tonight. Thank you. We have a nice way of closing.